Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 138. I'm recording it on Wednesday, May 13th, 2009. The P10 level today is 16. That's the high side of fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at the Incompetech.com site. The title of this selection is Blue Paint. The title of the podcast is Meet the New Financial Porn, Same as the Old Financial Porn. I have a question for you, dear listener. Is rock and roll a rebel music? It's promoted as that, isn't it? But I think it would be fair to say it's been a long time since rock and roll was a rebel music. I used to work at one of the the big six accounting/consulting firms. And I remember we went to a big meeting. Everybody had to go. It was some 3-day meeting, and everybody was upset to have time taken away from their other work. And to get us in a good mood, they started off the morning session with, you know, we're in this auditorium, and they're playing Taking Care of Business, you know, by Bachman-Turner Overdrive. This is rebel music. Rebel music they play at Big Six accounting firms. It was a great firm, great people. They paid me a lot of money. I better say they were great people. But, you know, they're not rebels. Maybe they think of themselves as rebels. Now, you know, the whole point of this podcast is we all like to think of ourselves as rebels today. Maybe not in another day. Maybe not in earlier ages. Maybe in earlier, you know, I remember it used to be Pepsi was, you know, they if you look for these you can find things out about earlier cultures, you know, by looking at old advertising campaigns. And they say, be sociable, drink Pepsi, you know. That was in the 50s, I think. So the idea then was to be sociable, to be liked, to be with the crowd. But in the 60s, it became be a rebel. And that we're still sort of in that phase today, I think. And so it's all about being a rebel. You know, listen to the Beatles, be a rebel. Now, you know, I'm not pointing good fingers at anyone. I'm totally guilty of it myself. But I like to think I have enough self-awareness to know that the Beatles did some wonderful music. But there were times when I bought Beatles albums, not because the music was wonderful, but because I had fallen for a marketing pitch. The greatest example of that was the White Album. I listened to that album every day for 6 months when I was in seventh grade. And I looked back at it a couple years ago and I thought, what a wretched piece of work that is. If it hadn't been the Beatles that put it out, it wouldn't have sold 500 copies. But because it was the Beatles, it sold 10 million. And, you know, that's just something that happens. And the ultimate example of it is truly, truly sad. And the joke is at my expense. But, you know, after the Beatles broke up, all of us Beatle fans were desperate for Beatle product. And so the individual Beatles started putting things out. And, you know, Paul McCartney put out a not such a great album, but there was an album came out by Yoko Ono, who wasn't a Beatles. You know, some people called her the fifth Beatle because she would hang around the Beatles. And it was called Fly, and it was a double album, you know, concept album. And all it was Yoko Ono pretending to be a fly, making sounds like a fly. It was a double album, and I bought this thing. I'm pretty sure I got it at a discount. I didn't pay full freight. But, you know, what earthly reason could someone have for buying such a piece of work? Why? I bought it because Yoko Ono was associated with the Beatles, and I wanted to be associated with the Beatles. It was marketing. That's how marketing works. Marketing is about appealing to emotional hot buttons. We all wanted to be like the Beatles. The Beatles were exciting. They were new. You know, they became spokesmen for a generation. And we all wanted to be part of that. It almost got me thrown out of school. You know, I wanted to have long hair, and you weren't allowed to have long hair. And they used to, you know, they used to follow me around. I used to get detention. My parents couldn't understand it. You know, what do you care? What do you have to fight this for? But that was more important to me than history or algebra or whatever. Marketing. And again, I'm not putting myself above it. I'm sure that I fall for marketing pitches today. I'm certain of it. I don't even say that we should live in a non-marketing age. I mean, maybe it would be a good thing, but I sort of have the view that that battle's been lost. And no, I would be ranting if I came on these podcasts and said, let's do away with marketing. It's like telling people to live off the grid. You know, they have this phrase in the frugal world. They say, oh, live off the grid. You know, we're going to go back to farming. And it's fine. If you want to do some of that, that's fine. But I'm not going to live off the grid. I like air conditioning, and I like DVDs, and I like, you know, computers, and I'm not going to live off the grid. But I do try to modify it. I try to learn about, you know, I don't buy, you know, 6 new cell phones every year. I try to moderate. And that's what you have to do, not only when you're buying cell phones. The frugal people will tell you to limit your spending, which is, you know, helpful. But how many people tell you to watch for the marketing pitches in the investing advice you hear? You need to do that. Most of it is marketing. And if it were all marketing, it wouldn't be as dangerous because you would see through it. The reality is, enough of it is true to entice you. Just like the White Album had a couple good songs on it, and the Beatles had a fantastic reputation. So enough of it was true to get me to buy the darn thing. But without some self-awareness that I had fallen for a marketing pitch, I ended up spending an hour a day for 6 months listening to the darn thing when I could have been doing something more productive. And that's where people are with in particular, passive investing, but in general, listening to money advice today. People, I don't think, are sufficiently aware that the way these strategies are developed is with marketing as the primary consideration. And the effectiveness of the strategies is secondary. When telling people things that works from a marketing standpoint, they do indeed tell you what works. Many of the big name advisors will tell you what works. But when telling you what works interferes with the marketing pitch, what works finishes second. And the marketing pitch finishes first. Now, I'm going to give an example, just to so you know what I'm worked up about. The Oblivious Investor blog, it's written by a guy, Mike Piper. And Mike is a good guy, and he's written a book, The Oblivious Investor, and he's going to send me a copy, and I hope to review it at the blog, at my blog, A Rich Life. And, you know, I don't agree. Mike advocates passive investing. That's his whole deal. And I do not. So Mike obviously knows I'm not going to endorse the ideas in the book. But what I hope to be able to do is to say in the first paragraph, look, I don't endorse this and everybody knows it. Read my site if you want to know why I don't endorse passive investing. But here are some good things about passive investing that Mike argues. I hope to be able to do that. I haven't read the book, but that's my hope. Because I think passive investors and rational investors should be friends. And I think I'm much more likely to advise Mike, or not to advise, to persuade Mike to tell the other side of the story if we can become friends than I am, you know, if I take a hostile attitude. The ideal is if I go to Mike's blog and help his readers understand the weaknesses of passive investing, and if Mike goes to my blog and helps my readers understand the weaknesses of rational investing. Because I'm not God either. And I'm going to get things wrong because I've got my marketing needs, of course, and I've got my own blind spots. That's the way it should work. So that, you know, but that's not the point here. I'm just giving background on Mike. But Mike has a blog entry today, Fooled by Wall Street. And this is the stuff that drives me crazy. He starts out, Wall Street tells us that the ways to build wealth are to 1, pick stocks, 2, pick the best fund manager, 3, time the market. Unfortunately, each of these things has a less than 50% probability of increasing your returns. Now, I'm going to tell you the reality. The reality is, if you were to try to sue Mike and say, it does, that's not true, these do not have a less than 50% probability, there's a piece of paper he could point to that is some called study that shows that each of these things has a less than 50% chance of working. Mike could produce that piece of paper, because I know the things he'd be looking at. But there's more than one way to interpret those pieces of paper. And I could show you a piece of paper that shows that each of those three things has a greater than 50% probability of increasing your returns. In other words, it's all interpretation. When he says pick stocks, picking stocks can increase your wealth dramatically if you know what you're doing. If you don't know what you're doing, it can destroy you. So it can be good or bad depending. It's not necessarily a bad thing. The suggestion here is it's necessarily a bad thing. Picking the best fund manager, again, that can be a losing proposition. It also can be a winning proposition. Depends how it's done. And timing the market, short-term timing doesn't work, I believe. Long-term timing always works. The same data that shows that short-term timing never works shows that long-term timing always works. So it just depends on what kind of timing you're talking about. So why is Mike... You know, I don't know to what extent he knows the weaknesses of these arguments. I don't know. But it wouldn't be hard to find out. He could go to my site, and he knows me, and he could go to other sites. There are other people that have explored this, Robert Shiller, lots of others. You know, what is it you're rebelling against exactly? This was the 50s, late 50s. What is it you're rebelling against exactly, motorcycle guy? And motorcycle guy says, what do you got? What do you got? You know, that's what it's... The people related to that, kids. Related to that. They were sick of something. You know, something in the water. Conventionalism, establishmentarianism, their parents, their teachers, the police, the church, something. And what do you got? They liked it. Because... They didn't really want to talk about what they were upset about. They just wanted to rebel. For good or for bad. I'm not making a judgment. I think rebellion has its good side. I also think it has its bad side. I'm not making a judgment. I'm saying it was an effective marketing pitch. It was emotional. It wasn't logical. There was logic that could be used to support it, certainly. And that was the whole point of the Beatles and Dylan and the Rolling Stones and all these things. They made the arguments in support of this rebel stance. And they got rich doing it. But the Rolling Stones aren't rebels. They're a corporation. They're big business. And it's okay to listen to their music and enjoy it, but if you don't understand their big business, you're fooling yourself. And if you don't understand that the people who advocate passive investing are not rebels, you're fooling yourself. So we've been duped. He's pointing the finger at Wall Street. Wall Street's out to get you, poor, innocent, middle-class investor. Only the passive investors are on your side. The financial service industry makes money when we trade stocks. They make money when we invest in actively managed funds. They make money when we jump in and out of the market. They're the bad guys, so-called Wall Street. Does John Bogle work on Wall Street? Where does John Bogle, where is Vanguard? Are they not at Wall Street? Are they not a mutual fund company? Are they not part of the stock selling industry? What are they? Jonathan Clements advocates passive investing. Jonathan Clements wrote a personal finance column for the Wall Street Journal. Is the Wall Street Journal not the establishment? in the personal finance field? Are they the rebels? Passive investing has been with us for 30 years. There's hundreds of millions of dollars have been used to market this stuff. They're the rebels? It's a joke, but it's a sad joke, because what goes on is, you know, this whole idea of, you know, we've all been contacted by, what are they called? Multi-level marketers, you know, people that, the most effective marketing. You see, the problem with marketing is people are always coming up with good ways of marketing, and then it wears off. It works great for a while, and then it wears off. So one of the things they came up with is use people's friends to market, because people trust their friends. In other words, people got to a point where they knew, tune out whatever's on television. You know, once the commercial comes on, tune it out. You know, go to the bathroom or get a drink of water. Tune out the message. But when your friend is sitting there at dinner and they say, hey, you know, I've started taking this nutrition mix and I feel a lot more energy lately, and I think you should look into it, and maybe, oh, really? That's interesting. Oh, maybe you would like a trial. I can give you a free trial. You know, I'm happy. Oh, of course. And you feel bad turning your friend down. Again, I'm not criticizing it. It's part of life. Marketing is part of life. Marketing serves a purpose. But you need to be wary of the messages. And what's going on with passive investing is the stock selling industry saw that this was a way to get rich. This was a way to bring in millions. And they got behind it, not necessarily as a, you know, in a cynical way. I think they believed in it. But they put hundreds of millions behind it all the same. And now they've got millions of little soldiers going to discussion boards and blogs, pitching this stuff at us, and they don't even make millions from it. They're doing it for the thrill of it. They believe. It's still marketing. The ideas still don't stand up to scrutiny. Some of them do. You know, they're partly right. Just like the nutrition product, I'm sure it does some good. I don't know anything about it, but my guess is it does. But is it worth, you know, $49.99, whatever it sells for? That's a different question. Is passive investing a good way to invest your money for retirement? I sure don't think so. I think it's a disaster. But Mel Lindauer thinks it's good, and John Graney thinks it's good. And they get very upset if their ideas are questioned. They're salesmen. There's millions of salesmen pushing this stuff on us. And I think it's time to start questioning the salesman. Not out of meanness, but because we need to know what works. We need to find out. Now, I want to read two. I'm gonna end up with 10 tips for how to deal with this reality, this phenomenon, that most personal finance advice is marketing. Not solely, but driven. That marketing is the primary consideration. But to set it up properly, I want to read two wonderful posts. And I've read these. I think I've read each of these on earlier podcasts, but they're two of my favorite posts of all time that I've ever seen on discussion boards. And so I can't repeat them often enough, as far as I'm concerned. This is one recently by Nisiprius at the... It is. Yeah, May 5th, 2009. This is a recent one at the Bogleheads board. Nisiprius. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful post. The big problem is that it's hard to know the right answer. You see, that's the problem in so much money advice, that what we're looking for from the quote-unquote experts is the right answer, and they don't know it. We're at a primitive level of our understanding. But for marketing purposes, you better sound like you know it, because that's what sells. That's what people want. So they pretend. They pretend a level of confidence that is not justified. The big problem is that it's hard to know the right answer. We are talking about investing for a lifetime, and the data, for example, in the widely used Ibbotson SBBI yearbooks, only covers a couple of lifetimes at best. In other words, we just don't know the answer. In the absence of real knowledge, the gap gets filled by people who sound knowledgeable. The gap gets filled by people who sound knowledgeable. Any financial expert can dazzle and baffle me by proving that they know 20 times as many detailed facts about which broker has the best bid-ask spread on a covered call on a reverse convertible debenture, or the ratio between United Widget's current account and its senior debt obligations. Have you ever heard gibberish like that from an investing quote-unquote expert? I bet you have. It's not an accident that they all talk that way. I'm sure there's some little booklet somewhere that tells people how to be an effective investing expert. And the trick is to intimidate. You've got to make people think you know something they don't. And they don't know how to invest effectively, because that's really not known with certainty. But what they sure can do is establish right off the front, right at first base, that there are things they know that you don't, and you sort of are intimidated, and you draw back, and you think, oh, I better not question them. They know so many facts, they've studied so much, and they manage multi-million-dollar funds. Holy moly, how could I ever? Oh, I'm so grateful to them for sharing what they know. They're such good people. I'm sure they're perfectly nice people. But they're playing a game. They're dressing up in daddy's clothes. They're acting, they're intimidating you with big words and hotshot arguments on things that don't matter, these trivialities, the covered call on a reverse convertible debenture, so that when it gets to the point where they say, don't ever change your stock allocation, even at insanely dangerous prices, you'll be too wowed to notice that it doesn't make any sense. They're intimidating you. They're softening you for the kill. Just like a used car salesman does. Having established that he knows, I'm back to the post. Having established that he knows far more than I do, I'm softened up and likely to believe that his pronouncements on what will do well over the next couple of years are knowledgeable too. 99% of what we hear about investing is just the confident-sounding pronouncement of authoritative-sounding people with good presentation skills. I'm reading that one again. 99% of what we hear about investing is just the confident-sounding pronouncements of authoritative-sounding people with good presentation skills. People who listen to each other and self-organize themselves into schools of thought. Only a tiny amount of it is directly databased at all. Sound bites are repeated over and over again. A good example is, quote, anyone investing in the stock market in 1929 who was able to hold on recovered by 1936. It's far from completely true, and it's far from completely untrue, but it gets repeated over and over again by people who obviously haven't even bothered to glance at a chart. See, these are half-truths. Most of what you hear are half-truths. Put there to persuade you. It's like a magician's trick. And the stuff that really matters just gets skimmed over. And all the half-truths have softened you up for the kill, and you fall for the marketing pitch. One of the things that's so... Well, I don't need to read that part. I need to skip down. Some convincing talkers are like a doctor in the 1800s. They may be completely sincere and really have their client's best interest at heart. And their sincerity and bedside manner carries conviction. But unfortunately, nevertheless, applying leeches mostly doesn't work. Believing that it's okay to stay at the same stock allocation when prices reach the levels that they were at from 1995 through 2008 is the equivalent of applying leeches as a doctor. There was a time when people believed that made sense. It's now been 28 years since the academic research has shown that it does not make sense. And people are still giving that advice today. Why? Because it's a marketing winner. People love it. Tell people timing doesn't work and you've got them eating out of your hand. Why? Because millions of middle-class investors are sick to death of get-rich-quick schemes. And when you tell people timing doesn't work, it sounds... Sounds is the key, is the verb here. It sounds like you're against get-rich-quick schemes. So it sells. The idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices go to insane levels is the biggest get-rich-quick scheme ever dreamed up in the history of personal finance, and the most damaging one. But it sounds good. If you don't look at it in depth, if you don't look at the historical data yourself, you wouldn't know. How many people know that the historical data shows the timing always works? How many people know that today? What percentage of the population? It's true. I've looked at the historical data with my own eyes. The historical data shows that short-term timing never works, and the historical data shows that long-term timing always works. So the statement, the historical data shows that timing doesn't work, is in some technical legal sense true. Because if you're questioned, you can point to a study that shows that. But the statement, timing always works, is just as true. Because if you're questioned on that statement, you could point to studies showing that long-term timing always works. So both statements are true. The question of which statement to use is just a marketing question. What are people going to believe? Now, if we were starting from scratch today, there would be no passive investing. There'd be no benefit in pushing passive investing. The stock selling industry would push rational investing. That's what works. Why wouldn't they want to tell people what works? Of course they would. But hundreds of millions of dollars have been invested in passive investing. People's reputations have been built on it. And the key to building a reputation in this field is credibility. And if you tell people you got it wrong for 30 years and you cause them to lose half of their retirement money, well, you know, you're going to take a hit in the credibility department. So right now, most people in the stock selling industry feel we better keep that little fact hushed up. We don't want word to get out that long-term timing always works. That's dangerous, as Mel Lindauer would say. Dangerous to let people hear that. Investors need to be, quote, protected from knowing about that. They need to be protected. My investor's prayer is, Lord, protect us from our protectors. Marketing is the driver. They're happy to tell the truth. They're happy to help us out. They are good people and they are smart people. But if you want to make a living in this field, marketing is first. It's a competitive field. And marketing means getting people to like you. And if you have believed, if you've invested as if timing doesn't work, and you've lost your retirement money, or a large part of it, because of that belief, the last thing you want to hear is that you made a mistake, that you were fooled, that you didn't have to lose that money, that it happened because you invested foolishly, you invested ineffectively, you didn't follow your common sense. So as of today, the marketing edge is still with those promoting passive investing. But is that always going to be true? I doubt it. It seems to me at some point we're going to drive this economy off a cliff if we don't start telling middle-class investors what works. So it seems to me, you know, we need to get about the business of turning this train around. You know, of having some limits on the marketing. Marketing is fine. But we can't allow it to be the only consideration. And at some point, we have to tell people the realities, or at least let them hear the realities along with the marketing stuff so they can decide for themselves which way to go. Here's another post, this one from Vanguard Diehards. This one was some time back, and it's by Cape Cod. Wonderful post about why we're in the mess we're in today. As someone intimately involved in the trading and investment business since the late 1960s, I felt for years that many individual investors have been unnecessarily damaged because the marketing push slash arguments that stress the benefits of passive investing have taken on the aura of a religion. It's important to recognize that, one, there are some real benefits that can accrue from passive investing. I, of course, agree. But two, there can also be some really devastating financial consequences from passive investing. And finally, three, like all other investment products, the passive investing slash limited asset reallocation product suite was, very successfully, developed in the marketing departments of financial product vendors when the old school distribution gang met early versions of the then new stat-based academic finance. This was passive investing as a product of the marketing departments. academic research played a role. Academic research is what told Wall Street they were going to have to change tactics, that the old stuff wasn't going to work, and they'd have to go to passive. They'd have to go to something new. And passive investing is what they came up with. But now the academic research has continued to advance to show that passive investing doesn't work, and they don't want to give up something they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars promoting. In times of market distress, these firms are filled with continuing self and group reassurances that the correct strategy is to, quote, stay the course and continue to average down, keep buying assets that are going the wrong way, because we cannot know what will happen next in markets. Sadly, most of the persons writing those reassurances demonstrate through their words, or just in feeling compelled to post, that they in fact do know what is going to happen next. But they are very emotionally and intellectually committed to inaction or limited action, because the many valid investing and marketing rationales that support the passive investment products have through time morphed into an unquestioning devotion. That's the truth about stock investing in the year 2009, according to Rob Bennett. Please, I'm telling you, don't trust gurus. I've got marketing on my mind. I've got something to sell. I've got a website. I don't have an investing book today, but I hope to someday. So you've got to take what I say, you know, with some caution as well. Check it out. Think it through. Look at the arguments of people who make the, you know, come at it from the other side. This is why I say I'd like to be friends with somebody like Mike at Oblivious Investor, because he can point out the weaknesses in my stuff better than I can, and I can point out the weaknesses in his stuff better than he can. We should all be working together as friends on the internet with the goal of exposing our own blind spots, with the ultimate goal of giving the best investing advice. But that's not the way it's working today. The way it's working today is the passives know. They don't know that their arguments are all wrong. They don't know how dangerous their arguments are, but they know there are weak spots. And so they're extremely defensive, and they ban honest discussion when the questions get too hard for them to handle. Now here's the logic chain that affects people who are in the field giving money advice. For money advice to have influence, it must be heard. Is that not true? You could have the most wonderful money advice in the world. If nobody hears it, doesn't do a darn bit of good, does it? So you must be heard. Logic chain element part two. To be heard, it must be marketed. How do you get heard in today's world? Marketing. Get your message out. Point three. To be marketed effectively, it must hit emotional hot buttons. That's what it's all about. Television commercials don't list the benefits of the product you're going to buy. They tell a story, or they make you laugh, or they make you angry, or they make you scared. They hit emotional hot buttons. That's the game. Point four, to hit emotional hot buttons, you must not get too caught up in what works. See, that's the killer. Most people in the money field would like to tell you what works. And they do. They include stuff that works in their strategies. But they can't let that be dominant if they want to win in the marketing game, usually, often. Not always, but often. Because there's a conflict. What works versus what sells. Mike, you know, I don't want to pick on Mike, but anyone advocating passive investing could tell us, hey, by the way, you know, long-term timing works. You know, all this stuff about short-term timing, it's important. I don't want you to short-term time. But long-term timing sure works. They could tell you that. But that dilutes the marketing message, doesn't it? Now, I think you could have as I say, if we were working from scratch, it wouldn't. Working from scratch, we would just tell people that long-term timing works, short-term timing doesn't, and we're off to the races. But we're 30 years in now. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars promoting passive investing. If we tell people that, you know, Vanguard's been sending out these monthly letters for 30 years getting it wrong, and the same thing with Fidelity, and the same thing with Money Magazine, and the same thing with the Wall Street Journal, Is that going to make all the people who have been promoting passive investing for decades now look like geniuses? It isn't. Now, I think it could make them look like something better than geniuses. It could make them look like people who are capable of admitting mistake. And I think in the long term, their credibility could actually go up if they just talk straight with people. That's what I advocate. But I think it'd be fair to say that I haven't persuaded the big shots just yet. They're not quite willing to take that step. It's sort of a circular game. They're willing to take the step if they're reassured that we're not going to get upset with them, and we're not willing to tell them that until we know the realities, and we can't know the realities until they tell us. And so it's all circular. Somewhere we have to break that chain so that we can start talking about what works versus what sells. Unfortunately, because of the hundred millions of dollars of marketing that went into passive investing, we've got a mountain to climb in getting to a point where we can tell people what works. But once we get there, we've got an approach to investing, rational investing, that lets people retire 5 years sooner, at least, for the average investor. And of course, it would bring our economy back, because people would regain confidence in the markets if they understood why they lost their retirement money and what they have to do to make sure it never happens again. So it's a win-win-win-win-win. There's not one person on planet Earth who would be hurt by us telling people the realities. But there are people who spend hundreds of millions promoting a failed strategy that believe that it would make them look bad. And what we need to do, the middle-class investors, is we need to persuade them that we want to hear what works, that we're not going to hold it against them. That's our job. That's our part of the project. So, you know, this something that I have realized. I tried it. You know, I'm always hitting on passive investing because this is how I learned about all this. I believed like everybody else. I just assumed, you know, until you get deep into this, you wouldn't believe this stuff. I believed, you know, when I started, I just thought everybody's trying to invest effectively. Why wouldn't they be? Of course they are. I didn't know that people were deliberately trying to, one, deceive themselves. And it's self-deception that always seems to come first. And two, deceive others, including their friends, their neighbors, their coworkers, just across the board. In other words, we're all trying to kid ourselves that we don't have to look at price when buying stocks. And of course, the sad thing is, you know, we have these frugality blogs all over the internet, people trying to save money. They're saying, how can I cut back on my cable bill? You know, which is fine. It's helpful. But you know how much you're going to spend on cable in your lifetime versus how much money you're going to put in stocks? The middle class person puts more money into stocks than any other thing he buys. More than houses, more than cars, more than cable, more than books, more than food. Most of us, if we're ever going to retire, we're going to have $1 million or more saved. So if you have a 70% stock allocation, that could mean you have $700,000 in stocks you bought. It's the biggest purchase of your lifetime. And you're not going to look at the price? You're not going to look at the price on something you spend $700,000 on? Holy moly. When you think about this stuff, it makes your head explode. But that's we've painted ourselves into a corner where it hurts our pride to acknowledge that it's a mistake not to look at the price of something we spent $700,000 of our hard-earned savings on. That's where we stand today, May of 2009. Our situation is so messed up that we can't acknowledge that it was a mistake to buy into the idea that you don't need to look at price when buying stocks. Timing doesn't work is a marketing slogan. That's all it is. Now, I think there was a time when people believed it was a scientific reality. I believe there was a time. And I believe that, I mean, people believe that today. I'm not saying they don't believe it, but there's no substance to the belief today. It's just a marketing slogan today. You have to think, what would have to be true for it to be true that timing doesn't work? For it to be true that timing just means changing your stock allocation in response to events. If you don't change your stock allocation in response to changes in price, you are implicitly saying that price doesn't matter. Price doesn't affect the long-term return. Because if price affected the long-term return, you obviously would change your stock allocation. The whole point of setting a stock allocation is to set the right risk-reward profile. The risk-reward profile obviously changes when the return changes. So if the price changes the return, you have to change your stock allocation to be logically consistent. But passive investing says no, you don't have to. Why? Because it sells. Why does it sell? You see, when I'm trying to argue that this statement is wrong, the timing does work, I can present, a mountain of historical data showing that it's always worked in the past and that logic shows it must work and that lots of big name experts have said it works and on and on and on. But I'll never persuade a person who has bought into the marketing pitch. Because if you bought into the marketing pitch, you're believing the timing doesn't work for emotional reasons, and I'm presenting rational reasons why it doesn't. And we're operating in two different languages. You're never going to, a rational reason's never going to persuade someone of what is an emotional truth for them. To change an emotional belief, I need to hit you on an emotional level. The one thing that's had an effect is the price crash. That's shaken people up because that affected people emotionally. People are scared. People feel they're not going to be able to retire on time. So that's emotional, and that had an effect. And so that softened the ground a little bit. So that logical arguments have a little bit more of a chance than they did before the crash. But my hope with this podcast is that you'll stop and think about why you believe this crazy idea, and you'll understand that your belief is a purely emotional belief. And when you come to believe that, you may see that, hey, it would be better to consider the rational arguments, not to rule them out. What is the great emotional appeal? Well, the great emotional appeal of passive investing, you can see it there at the Oblivious Investor blog, it's this rebel idea. We're better. People are scared of these experts. They're scared of Wall Street. For good reason, of course. And so what passive does is it says, hey, we got the solution. You don't have to worry about those big, bad Wall Street people. We'll protect you. Just stay at the same stock allocation and it'll be okay. Stocks will work for the long run. Buy and hold, stay the course. Pixie dust. Tommy doesn't work. It'll work out okay. It will. It won't work out okay because it's insane. Staying at the same stock allocation is insane. If you whatever allocation you pick, 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%, 50%, 60%, 70%, 80%, 90%, 100%, 0%, every single possibility makes sense at some valuation level and is stark raving Looney Tunes at another valuation level. So if you're sticking at the same one, sooner or later, I mean, there's going to be a time when it's great. There's going to be a time when you have the perfect allocation. But there's also going to be a time when you have an allocation that's stark raving Looney Tunes. And when it's stark raving Looney Tunes, you're probably going to lose all your money. And when you lose all your money, you're going to get out of stocks for life. So how are you going to end up with anything? You're going to have a few years. We don't know how many, but it depends on when you get started. But you're going to have a few years where you're going to do amazingly well and you're going to be very happy. Then you're going to lose most of your money. Then you're going to swear off stocks forever. How's that going to work for the long term? It can't work. Passive investing cannot work. It never has worked. It never can work. It's impossible. It's logically impossible that it could work. It can work for short periods of time. It can work, it can work really for decades. If you go from 75 to 2000, it worked. But rational investing worked from 75 to 95. So you don't have to believe in passive to get good results from 75 to 2000. The only time period in which passive worked and rational did it was 95 to 2000, 5 years. For those 5 years, passive was indeed superior. That's a fact. But at all other times, rational either does as well as passive or better. And in the long run, it always does better. For obvious reasons. It's sane. Doesn't make sense not to consider price. Doesn't make sense. So why do people love it? Why do people, what is the, You know, what is this emotional hot button? The emotional hot button is the phrase timing doesn't work, because that suggests to people that there's something about passive that is prudent. It sounds like a rejection of get-rich-quick schemes, and people love that. People are desperate for it. They want to get away from all the nonsense. That's why passive investing sells. It pretends to be a rebel strategy. Passive investing is about as rebel in 2099 as taking care of business is. It's suitable for play at a Big Six accounting firm meeting. And Big Six accountants are not rebels. They're nice people. They're not rebels. They're the establishment. And passive investing is the establishment investing advice today. It's dominant. So stop fooling yourself that you're taking some rebel course, that you're overcoming the trickery of Wall Street. You're playing into Wall Street's hands if you believe timing isn't necessary. Timing is necessary to have any hope of long-term investing success. You have got to change your stock allocation when prices go to insanely dangerous levels. You must, says Rob Bennett. Now, I want to go through. I have 10 little tips for trying to protect yourself, you know, make this practical. I'm arguing that investing advice is influenced by marketing considerations. Well, how do you protect yourself? How do you rise above that? And but one last point I wanted to make is that it's not only what I'm saying here is not only true with passive investing. It's true with all money advice. It's a real danger. I recently did a podcast. Dave Ramsey is not a straight shooter. And you can listen to it if you want to hear the whole story, but it took me a long time. I knew for a long time that Dave Ramsey was giving ridiculous numbers for what investments can earn in stocks. Ridiculous numbers for the valuation levels that applied. And I held back because I like Dave Ramsey. I think he's doing good work helping people to learn how to save. But I think I was wrong. I still want to say I like Dave Ramsey. I still encourage you to learn from him, just as I encourage you to learn from John Bogle and all the others. But I think if I'm going to be pointing out the weaknesses in John Bogle's ideas, to be fair and balanced, I have to point out the weaknesses in Dave Ramsey's ideas. And Dave Ramsey's advice on investing is poor advice. Stocks do not earn 12% at the valuation levels that applied from 1995 through 2008. Dave Ramsey may not know that, but if he doesn't know it, he should educate himself. That's his job, just as it's John Bogle's job to educate himself about the academic research of the past 30 years. And my hero, you want to talk about emotion, I love a man named Joe Dominguez. He's no longer with us. He's dead, but Joe Dominguez changed my life. I was trying to find out how to achieve financial freedom early in life. And I read Joe Dominguez's book, Your Money or Your Life, and it told me. And my heart started beating fast when I got to a certain page in that book. I remember. I don't remember the page, but my recollection is 160-something, but I could be wrong. But, I was reading that book like you watch a thriller. I was leaning forward, gritting my teeth, just like the tension was building because I could see where he was headed. I could see where his argument was going, and I was like, this is what I've been waiting for. This is what I've been looking for. And if he says what I think he's going to say, I'm going to bring this to my wife, and we are going to change how we live, starting today, starting here, starting now. Joe Dominguez is my hero, and I think, he's still my hero. But Joe Dominguez, in the chapter of his book on investing, argues that you can ignore inflation when calculating the return obtained by investing in treasury bonds. And that is gibberish. It's every bit as much gibberish as John Graney saying you can ignore valuations when determining the safe withdrawal rate. It's gibberish. And he did it for marketing reasons. Maybe he doesn't know that, but I think that's the factor. Because the problem is, Joe Dominguez, he had something he called a 9-step program. And one of the steps was he had to tell you where to invest the money. And he didn't want to tell you stocks, because he knew the dangers of stocks. Joe Dominguez was hip to that. And so he couldn't give the conventional advice. You know, well, buy and hold, I don't think, was even being promoted heavily. He came up with these ideas in the 60s, so buy and hold wasn't even being promoted back then. It was sort of being developed, but it wasn't being actively promoted. And he knew. So he wanted to tell people to invest in treasuries because they were safe. But if he told people the reality that investing in treasuries means, you know, you retire, it's going to take you twice as long to get to a safe retirement as it would if you invested in stocks, his whole thing would collapse. Nobody would buy his ideas. So I think he tricked himself, just as Bogle tricked himself and just as Ramsey tricked himself. He tricked himself into believing that inflation, you could ignore it. You know, he had this argument. You can continue cutting expenses enough to cover inflation. You know, that's lame. It's true that in the early going, you can cut expenses enough to cover inflation. That is true. I've done it. But by the time you hand in your resignation from a corporate job, you've done a lot of cutting, and there ain't too many more places to cut. I experienced that too. You get to a point where you really can't cut anymore, and inflation continues. And if you resign from your job at age 40, thinking inflation's not going to matter, by age 70, you're going to be in a whole big bunch of trouble. So Joe Dominguez's advice is wonderful. It's the best money advice ever offered on planet Earth. It's also dangerous as all get out, says Rob Bennett. Today, because of what I learned about passive investing, I've come to the conclusion that I need to point out this marketing gibberish. There's no way I can tell my message without doing it. We all need to become hip. We all need to develop filters so that we filter out the marketing. Because people have to market to sell. But we need to filter it out so that we can make good use of the 50% of their advice that's wonderful and tune out the 50% that's junk. John Bogle has a lot of wonderful ideas. Tune out this idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation and you've got gold there. So I want you to get the gold and I want you to filter out the trash. The idea that you don't need to change your stock allocation is, in Rob Bennett's view, trash. I can't state it strongly enough. Here are my 10 tips on how to filter out the trash and get the gold. And then I'll sign off. 1. I say you might need to mix and match. Don't, you know, one of those posts indicated, you know, he said how they form into schools. You see, they form into schools for marketing reasons. Because everybody in that school then it reinforces the marketing message. They used to have there was a guy, Attalos, one of the goons, and he used to make this phrase to me all the time about when he would advocate banning me from, you know, Vanguard Diehards or Bogleheads or wherever it was. He'd say, "Rob, you're like a dog lover posting at a cat lover board. You know, we're cat lovers. It's for cat lovers only. Go post on some bear board." Well, I'm not a bear. I love stocks. I love financial freedom. I love indexing. So I think I belong on Bogleheads. I belong at Vanguard Diehards. I love John Bogle. But I sure don't love passive investing. And I don't think you have to love passive investing to love John Bogle, because I learned why passive investing doesn't work from John Bogle. But the marketing reality is in tune with what Attalos said. Those boards are set up to promote a marketing pitch that passive investing works. They shouldn't be, says Rob Bennett. They should be about helping people invest in Vanguard funds. They should be about spreading John Bogle's good message. They should be about learning how to invest effectively. But what they are in reality is marketing pitches, says Rob Bennett. And it's true. If they're marketing pitches, Rob Bennett doesn't belong, because that ain't what I'm about. So Attalos made a good point. I think he's wrong, but it's an interesting point. The problem is that we're all forming into these schools, the good guys and the bad guys, and we can't learn from the other side. The enemy can't. Mix and match is the answer. Don't buy into one school of thought. Mix and match. Take the good from different places and leave the bad. Tip 2. Accept that we don't know it all today. Again, one of those posts I read talked about how we don't know it all. The reason these experts have to put on this show, like the Wizard of Oz, you know, cranking this and pulling the levers and making their voices sound loud and, you know, reciting facts, you know, putting out studies that really don't make any sense. Claiming that they're science. The reason they have to do all this stuff is because they don't know it all. And they're afraid to stand up on a podium and say, friends and neighbors, I don't know it all. But here's what I think. See, if they said that, the mix and match solves itself. Then we don't have to have enemy camps. But as long as this pretense is pushed that they know it all, they've got to keep out the people asking the hard questions. So we got to stop this pose, which means we have to accept some insecurity. It's a little scary to put your money in stocks knowing that you don't know it all. Well, that's life. It's like asking a girl to dance. If you wait, you know, are you only going to ask a girl to dance if you know 100% for sure she's going to say yes? Well, you know, fine, you can do that. You'll never get turned down. But your life experiences might get a little limited by taking that approach. You might miss out on the one who could have changed your life if you'd been willing to, you know, take a little chance. You have to invest in stocks. And investing in stocks is going to scare you. And the answer isn't to adopt a rigid dogma. The answer is to just accept that life has a little bit of risk to it and you need to live with a little bit of insecurity if you want to achieve financial freedom early in life. So says Rob Bennett. Tip 3, forget prefab solutions. They are always bad. Across the board, I don't like these prefab. You know, part of the reason why they defend the old school retirement studies is they say, oh, it's a rule of thumb. You know, let's just tell everybody 4% works. I don't do it. I say no. 4% doesn't always work. Sometimes the number's 2%. Sometimes it's 9%. Let's tell people the truth. Prefab. There's a place for prefab in this world, but not when designing your retirement plan, for heaven's sakes. You know, I go prefab when it's something I don't care about. You know, when I'm buying a new sneakers, some people, you know, they research, you know, all the brands and what's, and I'm like, look, my wife has to beg me to get new ones. I'll wear them. I don't care if there's holes in them. I just, you know, I don't want to take the time to go to the store to try them on. I just cannot be bothered. And she gets to a point where she just says, you know, I'm going to buy them for you. I can't stand to see you in those things anymore. And I don't want to put them on because I don't want to do the laces or whatever it is. You know, it's like, we have this battle every couple of years when I need new sneakers. But my point is, I'll go prefab on that one. I'll just say, look, get me, you know, I'll go with whatever I had before. And then they'll say, that's out of, we don't make that anymore. And I'm like, just get something close to it. I don't want to research what sneaker. I don't want to spend 10 more minutes in the store. Get me something. You know, I'll put it on. Prefab makes sense when it doesn't matter to you. I mean, I don't wear these shoes to run. I just, you know, it doesn't matter. There's a lot of things like that. But my retirement plan, I'm going to hand in a resignation from a corporate job at age 43 and I'm going to use a prefab number? No way. That is dumb. That is dumb. Dumb times 10. When it comes to your retirement plan, don't accept a prefab number. You know, do the math or go to a website where somebody took the time to do the math. Retirement risk evaluator. I attempted to do it. I'd be grateful if some other people would take a stab at the same thing and see if they come up with the same numbers. Yeah. Do the math if you're going to retire or if you're going to plan a retirement. Tip 4. Simple is good, but within limits. You know, the excuse that people will use is we've got to keep it simple for the middle-class investor. Well, fine. It's good to keep it simple. Bogle was an ace at that, and I applaud him for it. But there are limits. And this is the problem. This is where the marketing imperative poisons things. They say, keep it so simple. We don't even tell people that valuations affect long-term returns. And we cause, you know, the biggest market crash in history, or the second biggest, and it might turn out to be the biggest before it's over. No. No, no. Simple is good to a point. Simple isn't the end of the world. There comes a time where you have to get it right. 5, just be aware of the marketing imperative of North. I'm telling you, marketing influences all the investing and saving advice you hear. Well, just being aware of that will help you to filter it out. Don't think that these people are strictly out for your benefit, because they're not. They've got to make a living. They've got to market. Okay? If you keep that in mind, you'll be all right. You can take the good and leave the bad. Just being aware of the marketing imperative is a help. Now, point 6 cuts the other way. Don't be overly cynical. The risk I take when I tell people that 90% of the investing advice they've heard for the past 30 years is wrong is that people will become overly cynical and they'll start dismissing everything they hear from the experts, and a lot of what you hear is true. If you start saying, oh, Wall Street's bad, everything they say is bad, you know, the academics are bad, the studies don't work. Well, sometimes they do work. Sometimes they point to important truths. So you don't want to be naive and just think, well, because John Bogle said it, it must be true. And you don't want to be overly cynical. You don't want to say, John Bogle steered me wrong on passive investing, so I can't believe anything he says. That's not right. A lot of what he says is pure gold. I got on the path I'm on today by listening to John Bogle. So John Bogle is one of the best out there, as are a lot of the other passive investing advocates. Point 7. Always search for weaknesses in your own point of view. You know, this is the hardest of the tips to implement, because we all have a hard time saying those 3 magic words, I was wrong. Now, I have 2 articles at my website where I do this. One is, I have an article at the book I wrote section of the site. I forget the title, but it's 10 reasons why you shouldn't listen to Rob Bennett's investing advice, something like that. And I try to look in that article for character flaws or weaknesses in my skill set. And I just did it as an intellectual exercise, because I said I'm, you know, blasting all these other people. I better blast myself every now and then. And then I have one called 20 Flaws in the Valuation-Informed Indexing Strategy. I think everybody, I often make this claim. I say, you shouldn't invest in stocks unless you understand that valuations affect long-term returns. And I believe that. I don't think you should put $10 in stocks until you get that. You're just not ready. But I also believe you shouldn't become a valuation-informed indexer until you've read the article, 20 Reasons, Not To. The reason why I say that is, if you follow valuation-informed indexing, there's going to come a day when you have doubts. Guaranteed. And for the strategy to work, you have to stick with it for the long term. It's not a short-term strategy. And there's risk in that. Anytime you adopt something for the long term, there's risk, because it means it's less flexible. Short-term strategies are flexible. They don't work. That's the bad side. But they're flexible. Long-term strategies work if they're good. But of course, if they're bad, they're a disaster, because it's like tying yourself to the mast of a sinking ship, which is what the passives are doing today. So the time to be looking at the weak side of your strategy is before you put money in. So before you put $1 of your money at risk following a valuation-informed strategy, read the article, 20 Reasons Not to Do It. I, of course, don't conclude that you shouldn't do it. I just say, it's like the guy said that did that post, we don't know it all today, and here are some possible weak spots, things you should know about before you spend too much time on this. So I think that's the hardest one and possibly the most important one. Tip number 8, I think I'm up to. 7, 8. Sense of humor. Develop a sense of humor, especially about investing questions. Sense of humor. There's going to be a section, not a chapter, but a subsection of a chapter about sense of humor in my book. People don't think of having a sense of humor as a trait that makes you an effective investor, but it does. A sense of humor, it is partly telling funny jokes, but it's more you know, humor is more than just puns. You know, humor is, what humor comes from is being able to step back from a situation. You know, a ranter has no sense of humor. A person with a sense of humor can step back and sort of see both sides. And that's what makes a successful investor. Because a person with a sense of humor can never become too dogmatic. He's always going to be able to hear the other side, or even tell the other side, and he's always going to be able to laugh at himself. And if you can laugh at yourself, you're not going to fall for the worst of these marketing pitches. You might fall for some, but it won't kill you. And you'll be able to pull back. You'll be able to change your mind, which is critical. Develop a sense of humor. If you ask me what distinguishes the great investors from the weak investors, it's a sense of humor. Warren Buffett has a great sense of humor. Charlie Munger has a great sense of humor. John Bogle, I think, has a sense of humor. Sense of humor is the key. Nine, aim for being roughly right over being precisely wrong. What they do with a lot of these, you know, schools of thought that are really marketing pitches is they tell you got to buy the whole package. You see, if I can pick and choose Bogle's advice, you know, I could tell you five things about Bogle that are aces. But if I've got to buy the whole package, I've got to tell you reject it because it's poison. He's got that element in there, the passive element that ruins it. And the reason why they do that is it sells. People want to have the whole package. And what people have to understand is forget about getting it all right. We can't get it all right. We don't know enough to get it all right. Be satisfied with getting it roughly right. Tip number 10 is common sense should trump data. A really powerful force in marketing is to show people data. People want to hear that there's scientific support for what they're doing with their retirement money. You certainly should be using data to guide your strategies, I believe. I'm the biggest believer in the world. But you need to be careful. And a lot of us don't have time to look at the studies and research them on our own. If you don't have time, you have a powerful weapon to protect you from studies that are influenced or compromised by marketing concerns. And that weapon is common sense. The claim that you don't need to worry about the prices of the stocks you buy just doesn't pass the common sense test. So we all should have been highly skeptical about that claim from the first day. And we all should be ashamed that we weren't. And that includes me. I bought into that claim. And I'm ashamed of it. If you can graduate grade school, much less high school, much less college, you should have enough common sense to understand that the price of the stocks you buy has to affect the long-term return, and that therefore you need to be changing stock allocations when prices get, you know, insanely out of hand. So we never should have bought that. And any of the experts bought into that idea. They shouldn't have bought it. Nobody should have fell for that idea, but lots of smart people did. We need to all adopt a rule of, yes, being interested in what the data says, being interested in what the science says, but being skeptical because we don't know it all. We're on a journey, you know, maybe we're halfway there, maybe we're less than halfway there, maybe we're more than halfway there. We don't know it all in any event. And we need to be careful about, the worst thing is to believe something that isn't true. You know, that old Mark Twain saying, it's not the things you don't know that kill you. It's the things you think you know for certain that are just not so. So always exercise common sense. And if common sense tells you there's something fishy in the line you're being sold, pull back. And if the common sense explanation can be explained away, if there's a good explanation of why you shouldn't apply common sense, fine. Sometimes counterintuitive claims are true. But common sense should have made us more skeptical about the passive investing claim. The timing never works. That's a claim that does not pass the common sense test. Those are my 10 tips for filtering out the dangerous marketing that is mixed in with just about all the investing and saving truths that we hear from money experts today. If you have some thoughts, I hope you'll contact me at the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page. Good luck with your investing strategies.